where individual customers continue to exist in surveillance capitalist operations, purchasing Roomba vacuum cleaners, dolls that spy, smart vodka bottles, or behavior-based insurance policies, just to name a few examples, social relations are no longer founded on mutual exchange. In these and many other instances, products and services are merely hosts for surveillance capitalism's parasitic operations. Second, by historical standards, the large surveillance capitalists employ relatively few people compared to their unprecedented computational resources. This pattern, in which a small, highly educated workforce leverages the power of a massive, capital-intensive infrastructure, is called hyperscale. The historical discontinuity of the hyperscale business operation becomes apparent by comparing 7 decades of GM employment levels and market capitalization to recent post-IPO data from Google and Facebook. I have confined the comparison here to Google and Facebook because both were pure surveillance capitalist firms even before their public offerings. From the time they went public in 2016, Google and Facebook steadily climbed to the heights of market capitalization, with Google reaching $532 billion by the end of 2016, and Facebook reaching $332 billion, without Google ever employing more than 75,000 people, or Facebook more than 18,000. General Motors took 4 decades to reach its highest market capitalization of $225.15 billion in 1965, when it employed 735,000 women and men. Most startling is that GM employed more people during the height of the Great Depression than either Google or Facebook employs at their heights of market capitalization. The GM pattern is the iconic story of the United States in the 20th century, before globalization, neoliberalism, the shareholder value movement, and plutocracy unraveled the public corporation and the institutions of the double movement. Those institutions rationalized GM's employment policies with fair labor practices, unionization, and collective bargaining, emblematic of stable reciprocities during the pre-globalization decades of the 20th century. In the 1950s, for example, 80% of adults said that big business was a good thing for the country. 66% believed that business required little or no change, and 60% agreed that the profits of large companies help make things better for everyone who buys their products or services. Although some critics blamed these reciprocities for GM's failure to adapt to global competition in the late 1980s, leading eventually to its bankruptcy in 2009, analyses have shown that chronic managerial complacency and doomed financial strategies bore the greatest share of responsibility for the firm's legendary decline. A conclusion that is fortified by the successes of the German automobile industry in the 21st century, where strong labor institutions formally share decision-making authority. Hyperscale firms have become emblematic of modern digital capitalism, and as capitalist inventions, they present significant social and economic challenges, including their impact on employment and wages, industry concentration, and monopoly. In 2017, 24 hyperscale firms operated 320 data centers with anywhere between thousands and millions of servers. Google and Facebook were among the largest. Not all hyperscale firms are surveillance capitalists, however, and our focus here is restricted to the convergence of these two domains. The surveillance capitalists that operate at hyperscale or outsource to hyperscale operations dramatically diminish any reliance on their societies as sources of employees. And the few for whom they do compete, as we have seen, are drawn from the most rarefied strata of data science. The absence of organic reciprocities with people as either sources of consumers or employees is a matter of exceptional importance in light of the historical relationship between market capitalism and democracy. In fact, The origins of democracy in both America and Britain have been traced to these very reciprocities. In America, the violation of consumer reciprocities awakened an unstoppable march toward liberty as economic power translated into political power. A half century later in Britain, a grudging, practical, self-interested respect for the necessary independence of capital and labor translated into new patterns of political power, expressed in the gradual expansion of the franchise and the non-violent shift to more inclusive democratic institutions. Even a brief glance at these world-altering histories can help us grasp the degree to which surveillance capitalism diverges from capitalism's past. The American Revolution is the outstanding example of how the reciprocities of consumption contributed to the rise of democracy. Historian T.H. Breen argues in his pathbreaking study, The Marketplace of Revolution, that it was the violation of these reciprocities that set the revolution into motion, uniting disparate provincial strangers into a radical new patriotic force. Breen explains that American colonists had come to depend upon the empire of goods imported from England, and that this dependency instilled the sense of a reciprocal social contract. For ordinary people, the palpable experience of participating in an expanding Anglo-American consumer market intensified their sense of a genuine partnership with England. Eventually, the British Parliament famously misjudged the rights and obligations of this partnership, imposing a series of taxes that turned imported goods such as cloth and tea into symbols of imperial oppression. Breen describes the originality of a political movement born in the shared experience of consumption, the outrage at the violation of essential producer-consumer interdependencies, and the determination to make goods speak to power. The translation of consumer expectations into democratic revolution occurred in three waves, beginning in 1765, when the Stamp Act triggered popular protests, riots, and organized resistance, finally expressed in the non-importation movement. Today we would call it a consumer boycott. As Breen tells it, the details of the Stamp Act were less important than the colonists' realization that England did not perceive them as political or economic equals, bound in mutually beneficial reciprocities. By compromising the Americans' ability to purchase the goods they desired, Parliament had revealed an intention to treat the colonists like second-class subjects, levying a high price on the pursuit of material happiness. The Stamp Act was experienced as a violation of the colonists' rights not only as subjects of the empire, but also as consumers of the empire. It was the first translation of consumers' economic power into political power, a radically new form of politics in which the most ordinary members of colonial society experienced an exhilarating surge of empowerment. Parliament withdrew the Stamp Act before the non-importation movement could effectively spread across the colonies, and it appeared that the principle of no taxation without representation had prevailed. When the Townshend Acts were passed just 2 years later in 1767, this time imposing taxes on a range of imported goods, a new wave of outrage mobilized people in every colony. Detailed non-importation agreements turned consumer sacrifice into the front line of political resistance. The shared experience of violated expectations cut across regional, religious, and cultural differences, providing a new basis for social solidarity. By 1770, the Townshend Acts were also repealed, and once again it seemed that a full-blown rebellion would be avoided. In 1773, Tea Act plunged the colonies into a new phase of resistance that shifted the political focus from non-importation, which depended upon merchants holding the line, to non-consumption, which demanded the participation of all individuals in the unique solidarity of their shared status as customers. It was in this context that Samuel Adams proclaimed that the cause of liberty depended on the ability of the American people to free themselves from the baubles of Britain. British goods had so thoroughly come to symbolize dependency and oppression that when the tiny, impoverished community of Harvard, Massachusetts, gathered to discuss the merchant vessels arriving in Boston Harbor loaded with chests of tea, they deemed it a matter of as interesting and important a nature when viewed in all its consequences, not only to this town and province, but to America in general, and that for ages and generations to come, as ever came under the deliberation of this town. A year later, in 1774, the First Continental Congress convened in Philadelphia and produced a grand scheme to abolish trade with England. It brought to fruition a brilliantly original strategy of consumer resistance to political oppression, Breen writes. One that had invited Americans to think of themselves as Americans even before they entertained a thought of independence. In early 19th century Britain, as Daron Acemoglu and James A. Robinson have shown, the rise of democracy was inextricably bound to industrial capitalism's dependency on the masses and their contribution to the prosperity necessitated by the new organization of production. The rise of volume production and its wage-earning labor force established British workers' economic power and led to a growing appreciation of their political legitimacy and power. This produced a new sense of interdependence between ordinary people and elites. Acemoglu and Robinson conclude that the dynamic positive feedback between inclusive economic institutions, that is, industrial firms defined by employment reciprocities, and political institutions, was critical to Britain's substantial and non-violent democratic reforms. Inclusive economic institutions, they argue, level the playing field, especially when it comes to the fight for power, making it more difficult for elites to crush the masses rather than accede to their demands. Reciprocities in employment produced and sustained reciprocities in politics. Clamping down on popular demands and undertaking a coup against inclusive political institutions would destroy economic gains, and the elites opposing greater democratization and greater inclusiveness might find themselves among those losing their fortunes from this destruction. In sharp contrast to the pragmatic concessions of Britain's early industrial capitalists, surveillance capitalists' extreme structural independence from people breeds exclusion rather than inclusion and lays the foundation for the unique approach that we have called radical indifference. 3. The New Collectivism and Its Masters of Radical Indifference. The accumulation of freedom and knowledge combines with the lack of organic reciprocities with people to shape a third unusual feature of surveillance capitalism, a collectivist orientation that diverges from the long-standing values of market capitalism and market democracy, while also sharply departing from surveillance capitalism's origins in the neoliberal worldview. For the sake of its own commercial success, surveillance capitalism aims us toward the hive collective. This privatized, instrumentarian social order is a new form of collectivism in which it is the market, not the state, which concentrates both knowledge and freedom within its domain. This collectivist orientation is an unexpected development in light of surveillance capitalism's origins in a neoliberal creed conceived 60 years ago as a reaction to the collectivist totalitarian nightmares of the mid-20th century. Later, with the demise of the fascist and socialist threats, neoliberal ideology cunningly succeeded in redefining the modern democratic state as a fresh source of collectivism to be resisted by any and all means. Indeed, the evisceration of the double movement has been prosecuted in the name of defeating the supposed collectivist hazards of too much democracy. Now the hive emulates the termite state, which even the democracy-despising Hayek derided as incompatible with human freedom. The convergence of freedom and knowledge transforms surveillance capitalists into society's self-appointed masters. From their high perch in the division of learning, a privileged priesthood of tuners rules the connected hive, cultivating it as a source of continuous raw material supply. Just as early 20th century managers were once taught the administrative point of view as the mode of knowledge required for the hierarchical complexities of the new large-scale corporation, today's high priests practice the applied arts of radical indifference, a fundamentally asocial mode of knowledge. With the application of radical indifference, content is judged by its volume, range, and depth of surplus, as measured by the anonymous equivalents of clicks, likes, and dwell times, despite the obvious fact that its profoundly dissimilar meanings originate in distinct human situations. Radical indifference is a response to economic imperatives, and only occasionally do we catch an unobstructed view of its strict application as a managerial discipline. One such occasion was a 2016 internal Facebook memo acquired by BuzzFeed in 2018. Written by one of the company's long-standing and most influential executives, Andrew Bosworth, it provided a window into radical indifference as an applied discipline. "We talk about the good and the bad of our work often. I want to talk about the ugly," Bosworth began. He went on to explain how equivalence wins out over equality in the world view of an organism among organisms that is essential to the march toward totality, and thus the growth of surveillance revenues. "We connect people. That can be good if they make it positive. Maybe someone finds love. Maybe it even saves the life of someone on the brink of suicide. So we connect more people. That can be bad if they make it negative. Maybe it costs a life by exposing someone to bullies. Maybe someone dies in a terrorist attack coordinated on our tools. And still we connect people. The ugly truth is that anything that allows us to connect more people more often is de facto good. It is perhaps the only area where the metrics do tell the true story as far as we are connected. That's why all the work we do in growth is justified. All the questionable contact importing practices, all the subtle language that helps people stay searchable by friends, all of the work we do to bring more communication in. The best products don't win. The ones everyone uses win. Make no mistake, growth tactics are how we got here." As Bosworth makes clear, from the viewpoint of radical indifference, the positives and negatives must be viewed as equivalent, despite their distinct moral meanings and human consequences. From this perspective, the only rational objective is the pursuit of products that snare everyone, not the best products. A significant result of the systematic application of radical indifference is that the public-facing first text is vulnerable to corruption with content that would normally be perceived as repugnant. Lies, systematic disinformation, fraud, violence, hate speech, and so on. As long as content contributes to growth tactics, Facebook wins. This vulnerability can be an explosive problem on the demand side, the user side, but it breaks through the fortifications of radical indifference only when it threatens to interrupt the flow of surplus into the second shadow text. The one that is for them, but not for us. The norm is that information corruption is not catalogued as problematic unless it poses an existential threat to supply operations. Bosworth's imperative of connection, either because it might trigger user disengagement or because it might attract regulatory scrutiny. This means that any efforts toward content moderation are best understood as defensive measures, not as acts of public responsibility. So far, the greatest challenge to radical indifference has come from Facebook and Google's overreaching ambitions to supplant professional journalism on the Internet. Both corporations inserted themselves between publishers and their populations, subjecting journalistic content to the same categories of equivalence that dominate surveillance capitalism's other landscapes. In a formal sense, professional journalism is the precise opposite of radical indifference. The journalist's job is to produce news and analysis that separate truth from falsehood. This rejection of equivalence defines journalism's raison d'etre as well as its organic reciprocities with its readers. Under surveillance capitalism, though, these reciprocities are erased. A consequential example was Facebook's decision to standardize the presentation of its newsfeed content so that all news stories looked roughly the same as each other, whether they were investigations in the Washington Post, gossip in the New York Post, or flat-out lies in the Denver Guardian, an entirely bogus newspaper. This expression of equivalence without equality made Facebook's first text exceptionally vulnerable to corruption from what would come to be called fake news. This is the context in which Facebook and Google became the focus of international attention following the discovery of organized political disinformation campaigns and profit-driven fake news stories during the 2016 U.S. presidential election and the UK Brexit vote earlier that year. Economists Hunt Alcott and Matthew Jenskow, who have studied these phenomena in detail, define fake news as distorted signals uncorrelated with the truth that impose private and social costs by making it more difficult to infer the true state of the world. They found that in the lead-up to the 2016 U.S. election, there were 760 million instances of a user reading these intentionally orchestrated lies online, or about three such stories for each adult American. As radical indifference would predict, however, fake news and other forms of information corruption have been perennial features of Google and Facebook's online environments. There are countless examples of disinformation that survived and even thrived because it fulfilled economic imperatives, and I point out just a few. In 2007, a prominent financial analyst worried that the subprime mortgage bust would harm Google's lucrative ad business. It seems a strange observation, until you learn that in the years prior to the Great Recession, Google eagerly welcomed shady subprime lenders into its behavioral futures markets, anxious to net the lion's share of the $200 million in monthly revenue that mortgage lenders were spending on online advertising. A 2011 consumer watchdog report on Google's advertising practices leading up to and during the Great Recession concluded that Google has been a prominent beneficiary of the national home loan and foreclosure crisis by accepting deceptive advertising from fraudulent operators who falsely promise unwary consumers that they can solve their mortgage and credit problems. Despite these increasingly public facts, Google continued to serve its fraudulent business customers until 2011, when the U.S. Treasury Department finally required the company to suspend advertising relationships with more than 500 internet advertisers associated with the 85 alleged online mortgage fraud schemes and related deceptive advertising. Only a few months earlier, the Department of Justice had fined Google $500 million, one of the largest financial forfeiture penalties in history, for accepting ads from online Canadian pharmacies that encouraged Google's U.S. users to illegally import controlled drugs, despite repeated warnings. As the U.S. Deputy Attorney General told the press, the Department of Justice will continue to hold accountable companies who, in their bid for profits, violate federal law and put at risk the health and safety of American consumers. Information corruption has also been a continuous feature of the Facebook environment. The turmoil associated with the 2016 U.S. and U.K. political disinformation campaigns on Facebook was a well-known problem that had disfigured elections and social discourse in Indonesia, the Philippines, Colombia, Germany, Spain, Italy, Chad, Uganda, Finland, Sweden, Holland, Estonia, and the Ukraine. Scholars and political analysts had called attention to the harmful consequences of online disinformation for years. One political analyst in the Philippines worried in 2017 that it might be too late to fix the problem. "We already saw the warning signs of this years ago. Voices that were lurking in the shadows are now at the center of the public discourse." The guiding principles of radical indifference are reflected in the operations of Facebook's hidden, low-wage labor force charged with limiting the perversion of the first text. Nowhere is surveillance capitalism's outsized influence over the division of learning in society more concretely displayed than in this outcast function of content moderation. And nowhere is the nexus of economic imperatives and the division of learning more vividly exposed than in the daily banalities of these rationalized workflows, where the world's horrors and hate are assigned to life or death at a pace and volume that leave just moments to point thumbs up or thumbs down. It is only thanks to the determined reporting of a handful of investigative journalists and research scholars that we even have a glimpse of these highly secretive procedures, which now spread across a range of call centers, boutique firms, and micro-labor sites around the world. As one account notes, Facebook and Pinterest, along with Twitter, Reddit, and Google, all declined to provide copies of their past or current internal moderation policy guidelines. Among the few reports that have managed to assess Facebook's operations, the theme is consistent. This secret workforce, some estimates reckon at least 100,000 content moderators, and others calculate the number to be much higher, operates at a distance from the corporation's core functions, applying a combination of human judgment and machine learning tools. Sometimes referred to as janitors, they review cues of content that users have flagged as problematic. Although some general rules apply across the board, such as eliminating pornography and images of child abuse, a detailed rulebook aims to reject as little content as possible in the context of a local assessment of the minimum threshold of user tolerance. The larger point of the exercise is to find the point of equilibrium between the ability to pull users and their surplus into the site and the risk of repelling them. This is a calculation of radical indifference that has nothing to do with assessing the truthfulness of content or respecting reciprocities with users. This tension helps to explain why disinformation is not a priority. One investigative report quotes a Facebook insider. "They absolutely have the tools to shut down fake news." That radical indifference produces equivalence without equality also affects the high science of targeted advertising. For example, journalist Julia Engwin and her colleagues at ProPublica discovered that Facebook enabled advertisers to direct their pitches to the news feeds of almost 2,300 people who expressed interest in the topics of Jew hater, how to burn Jews, or history of why Jews ruin the world. As the journalists explained, Facebook has long taken a hands-off approach to its advertising business. Facebook generates its ad categories automatically, based both on what users explicitly share with Facebook and what they implicitly convey through their online activity. Similarly, reporters at BuzzFeed discovered that Google enables advertisers to target ads to people who type racist terms into the search bar, and even suggests ad placements next to searches for "evil Jew" and "Jewish control of banks." In the 2017 post-election environments in the United States and the United Kingdom, as fake news dominated the spotlight, journalists discovered hundreds of examples in which prediction products had placed ads from legitimate brands such as Verizon, AT&T, and Walmart, alongside heinous material, including disinformation sites, hate speech, extreme political content, and terrorist, racist, and anti-Semitic publications and videos. Most interesting was the assumed outrage and disbelief among surveillance capitalism's customers, the advertising agencies and their clients, who long ago chose to sell their souls to radical indifference, turning Google and Facebook into the duopoly of the online ad market and driving the massive expansion of surveillance capitalism. It had been nearly two decades since Google invented the formula that ceded ad placement to the equivalency metrics of click-through rates, supplanting earlier approaches that sought to align advertising placements with content that reflected the advertiser's brand values. Customers forfeited those established reciprocities in favor of the auto-magic of Google's secret algorithms trained on proprietary behavioral surplus culled from unwitting users. Indeed, it was the radical indifference of click metrics that bred online displays of extremism and sensationalism in the first place, as prediction products favor content designed to magnetize engagement. The election scandals shined a harsh spotlight on these settled practices, to which the world had already become accustomed. In the heat of controversy, many top brands made a show of suspending their ads on Google and Facebook until the companies eliminated corrupt content or guaranteed acceptable ad placements. Politicians in Europe and the United States accused Google and Facebook of profiting from hatred and of weakening democracy with corrupt information. Initially, both companies seemed to assume that the noise would quickly fade. Mark Zuckerberg said it was crazy to think that fake news had influenced the elections. Google responded to its advertising customers with vague platitudes, offering little in the way of change. This was not the first time that the leading surveillance capitalists had been called to account by public and press. In addition to the many cycles of outrage generated by Street View, Beacon, Gmail, Google Glass, Newsfeed, and other incursions, Edward Snowden's 2013 revelations of the tech company's collusion with state intelligence agencies triggered an international eruption of loathing toward the surveillance capitalists. Google and Facebook learned to weather these storms with what I have called the dispossession cycle, and close observation of this new crisis suggested that a fresh cycle was in full throttle. As the threat of regulatory oversight grew, the adaptation phase of the cycle set in with a vengeance. There were public apologies, acts of contrition, attempts at mollification, and appearances before the U.S. Congress and the EU Parliament. Zuckerberg regretted his dismissive attitude and prayed for forgiveness on the Jewish Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. Sheryl Sandberg told ProPublica that, "We never intended or anticipated this functionality being used this way." Facebook conceded that it could do more to combat online extremism. Google's European chief told customers, "We apologize. Whenever anything like this happens, we don't want it to happen and we take responsibility for it." Consistent with the aims of the adaptation phase of the cycle, Bloomberg Businessweek observed of Google, "The company is trying to fight fake news without making sweeping changes." Although both Google and Facebook made modest operational adjustments to try to diminish economic incentives for disinformation and instituted warning systems to alert users to probable corruption, Zuckerberg also used his super voting power to reject a shareholder proposal that would have required the company to report on its management of disinformation and the societal consequences of its practices. And Google executives successfully fought back a similar shareholder proposal that year. Time would tell whether the company's users and customers would inflict financial punishment, and if so, how sustained that punishment might be. By early 2018, a quiet shift from adaptation to redirection at Facebook was already poised to transform crisis into opportunity. "Despite facing important challenges, we also need to keep building new tools to help people connect, strengthen our communities, and bring the world closer together," Zuckerberg told investors. A Zuckerberg post, followed up by a statement from the head of the company's newsfeed, declared that, henceforth, the newsfeed would favor posts from friends and family, especially posts that spark conversations and meaningful interactions between people. We will predict which posts you might want to interact with your friends about. These are posts that inspire back-and-forth discussion, whether that's a post from a friend seeking advice, a news article or video prompting lots of discussion. Live videos often lead to discussion among viewers, 6 times as many interactions as regular videos. Radical indifference means that it doesn't matter what is in the pipelines as long as they are full and flowing. Camouflaged as a retreat from corruption, the new strategy doubled down on activities rich in behavioral surplus, especially the live videos that Zuckerberg had long coveted. In a New York Times report, advertisers were quick to observe that the new rules would fuel Facebook's long-held video ambitions, and that the company had made clear its belief that its future lay in videos and video ads. One advertising executive commented that video content is among the most shared and commented upon content on the web. Beyond all the explanations for the scourge of disinformation in the surveillance capitalist online environment is a deeper and more intransigent fact. Radical indifference is a permanent invitation to the corruption of the first text. It sustains the pathological division of learning in society by forfeiting the integrity of public knowledge for the sake of the volume and scope of the shadow text. Radical indifference leaves a void where reciprocities once thrived. For all their freedom and knowledge, this is one void that surveillance capitalists will not fill, because doing so would violate their own logic of accumulation. It is obvious that the rogue forces of disinformation grasp this fact more crisply than do Facebook's or Google's genuine users and customers, as those forces learn to exploit the blind eye of radical indifference and escalate the perversion of learning in an open society. 4. What is surveillance capitalism? Surveillance capitalism's successful claims to freedom and knowledge, its structural independence from people, its collectivist ambitions, and the radical indifference that is necessitated, enabled, and sustained by all three, now propel us toward a society in which capitalism does not function as a means to inclusive economic or political institutions. Instead, surveillance capitalism must be reckoned as a profoundly anti-democratic social force. The reasoning I imply is not mine alone. It echoes Thomas Paine's unyielding defense of the democratic prospect in The Rights of Man, the polemical masterpiece in which he contested the defense of monarchy in Edmund Burke's Reflections on the Revolution in France. Paine argued for the capabilities of the common person and against aristocratic privilege. Among his reasons to reject aristocratic rule was its lack of accountability to the needs of the people. Because a body of men holding themselves accountable to nobody ought not to be trusted by anybody. Surveillance capitalism's anti-democratic and anti-egalitarian juggernaut is best described as a market-driven coup from above. It is not a coup d'état in the classic sense, but rather a coup de genre, an overthrow of the people concealed as the technological Trojan horse that is Big Other. On the strength of its annexation of human experience, this coup achieves exclusive concentrations of knowledge and power that sustain privileged influence over the division of learning in society. The privatization of the central principle of social ordering in the 21st century. Like the adelantados and their silent incantations of the requerimiento, surveillance capitalism operates in a declarative form and imposes the social relations of a pre-modern absolutist authority. It is a form of tyranny that feeds on people, but is not of the people. In a surreal paradox, this coup is celebrated as personalization, although it defiles, ignores, overrides, and displaces everything about you and me that is personal. Tyranny is not a word that I choose lightly. Like the instrumentarian hive, tyranny is the obliteration of politics. It is founded on its own strain of radical indifference, in which every person, except the tyrant, is understood as an organism among organisms in an equivalency of other ones. Hannah Arendt observed that tyranny is a perversion of egalitarianism because it treats all others as equally insignificant. The tyrant rules in accordance with his own will and interest, the ruler who rules one against all, and the all he oppresses are all equal, namely equally powerless. Arendt notes that classical political theory regarded the tyrant as out of mankind altogether, a wolf in human shape. Surveillance capitalism rules by instrumentarian power through its materialization in Big Other, which, like the ancient tyrant, exists out of mankind while paradoxically assuming human shape. Surveillance capitalism's tyranny does not require the despot's whip any more than it requires totalitarianism's camps and gulags. All that is needed can be found in Big Other's reassuring messages and emoticons. The press of the others not in terror, but in their irresistible inducements to confluence. The weave of your shirt saturated with sensors. The gentle voice that answers your queries. The TV that hears you, the house that knows you, the bed that welcomes your whispers, the book that reads you. Big Other acts on behalf of an unprecedented assembly of commercial operations that must modify human behavior as a condition of commercial success. It replaces legitimate contract, the rule of law, politics, and social trust with a new form of sovereignty and its privately administered regime of reinforcements. Surveillance capitalism is a boundaryless form that ignores older distinctions between market and society, market and world, or market and person. It is a profit-seeking form in which production is subordinated to extraction as surveillance capitalists unilaterally claim control over human, societal, and political territories extending far beyond the conventional institution terrain of the private firm or the market. Using Karl Polanyi's lens, we see that surveillance capitalism annexes human experience to the market dynamic so that it is reborn as behavior, the fourth fictional commodity. Polanyi's first three fictional commodities, land, labor, and money, were subjected to law. Although these laws have been imperfect, the institutions of labor law, environmental law, and banking law are regulatory frameworks intended to defend society and nature, life, and exchange from the worst excesses of raw capitalism's destructive power. Surveillance capitalism's expropriation of human experience has faced no such impediments. The success of this coup de jean stands as sour testimony to the thwarted needs of the second modernity, which enabled surveillance capitalism to flourish and still remains its richest vein for extraction and exploitation. In this context, it is not difficult to understand why Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg offers his social network as the solution to the third modernity. He envisions a totalizing instrumentarian order. He calls it the new global church that will connect the world's people to something greater than ourselves. It will be Facebook, he says, that will address problems that are civilizational in scale and scope, building the long-term infrastructure to bring humanity together, and keeping people safe with artificial intelligence that quickly understands what is happening across our community. Like Pentland, Zuckerberg imagines machine intelligence that can identify risks that nobody would have flagged at all, including terrorists planning attacks using private channels, people bullying someone too afraid to report it themselves, and other issues, both local and global. When asked about his responsibility to shareholders, Zuckerberg told CNN, "That's why it helps to have control of the company." For more than three centuries, industrial civilization aimed to exert control over nature for the sake of human betterment. Machines were our means of extending and overcoming the limits of the animal body so that we could accomplish this aim of domination. Only later did we begin to fathom the consequences. The Earth, overwhelmed in peril as the delicate physical systems that once defined sea and sky, gyrated out of control. Right now, we are at the beginning of a new arc that I have called Information Civilization. And it repeats the same dangerous arrogance. The aim now is not to dominate nature, but rather human nature. The focus has shifted from machines that overcome the limits of bodies to machines that modify the behavior of individuals, groups, and populations in the service of market objectives. This global installation of instrumentarian power overcomes and replaces the human inwardness that feeds the will to will and gives sustenance to our voices in the first person, incapacitating democracy at its roots. The rise of instrumentarian power is intended as a bloodless coup, of course. Instead of violence directed at our bodies, the instrumentarian third modernity operates more like a taming. Its solution to the increasingly clamorous demands for effective life pivots on the gradual elimination of chaos, uncertainty, conflict, abnormality, and discord in favor of predictability, automatic regularity, transparency, confluence, persuasion, and pacification. We are expected to cede our authority, relax our concerns, quiet our voices, go with the flow and submit to technological visionaries whose wealth and power stand as assurance of their superior judgment. It is assumed that we will accede to a future of less personal control and more powerlessness, where new sources of inequality divide and subdue, where some of us are subjects and many are objects, some are stimulus and many are response. The compulsions of this new vision threaten other delicate systems, also many millennia in the making. But this time, they are social and psychological. I am thinking here of the hard-won fruits of human suffering and conflict that we call the democratic prospect, and the achievements of the individual as a source of autonomous moral judgment. Technological inevitability is the mantra on which we are trained, but it is an existential narcotic prescribed to induce resignation, a snuff dream of the spirit. We've been alerted to the sixth extinction, as vertebrate species disappear faster than at any time since the end of the dinosaurs. This cataclysm is the unintended consequence of the reckless and opportunistic methods, also exalted as inevitable, with which industrialization imposed itself on the natural world because its own market forms did not hold it to account. Now the rise of instrumentarian power, as the signature expression of surveillance capitalism, augurs a different kind of extinction. This seventh extinction will not be of nature, but of what has been held most precious in human nature. The will to will. The sanctity of the individual, the ties of intimacy, the sociality that binds us together in promises, and the trust they breed. The dying off of this human future will be just as unintended as any other. 5. Surveillance Capitalism and Democracy. Instrumentarian power has gathered strength outside of mankind, but also outside of democracy. There can be no law to protect us from the unprecedented, and democratic societies, like the innocent world of the Tainos, are vulnerable to unprecedented power. In this way, surveillance capitalism may be viewed as part of an alarming global drift toward what many political scientists now view as a softening of public attitudes toward the necessity and inviolability of democracy itself. Many scholars point to a global democratic recession or a deconsolidation of Western democracies that were long considered impervious to anti-democratic threats. The extent and precise nature of this threat are being debated, but observers describe the bitter saudade associated with rapid social change and fear of the future conveyed in the lament, "My children will not see the life that I lived." Such feelings of alienation and unease were expressed by many people around the world in a 38-nation survey published by Pew Research in late 2017. The findings suggest that the democratic ideal is no longer a sacred imperative, even for citizens of mature democratic societies. Although 78% of respondents say that representative democracy is good, 49% also say that rule by experts is good, 26% endorse rule by a strong leader, and 24% prefer rule by the military. The weakening attachment to democracy in the United States and many European countries is of serious concern. According to the Pew survey, only 40% of U.S. respondents support democracy and simultaneously reject the alternatives. A full 46% find both democratic and non-democratic alternatives to be acceptable, and 7% favor only the non-democratic choice. The U.S. sample trails Sweden, Germany, the Netherlands, Greece, and Canada in its depth of commitment to democracy. But other key Western democracies, including Italy, the UK, France, and Spain, along with Poland and Hungary, fall at or below the 38-country median of 37% that are exclusively committed to democracy. Many have concluded from this turmoil that market democracy is no longer viable, despite the fact that the combination of markets and democracy has served humanity well, helping to lift much of humankind from millennia of ignorance, poverty, and pain. For some of these thinkers, it is the markets that must go, and for others, it is democracy that's slated for obsolescence. Repulsed by the social degradation and climate chaos produced by nearly four decades of neoliberal policy and practice, an important and varied group of scholars and activists argues that the era of capitalism is at end. Some propose more humane economic alternatives, some anticipate protracted decline, and others, repelled by social complexity, favor a blend of elite power and authoritarian politics in closer emulation of China's authoritarian system. These developments alert us to a deeper truth. Just as capitalism cannot be eaten raw, people cannot live without the felt possibility of homecoming. Hannah Arendt explored this territory more than 60 years ago in The Origins of Totalitarianism, where she traced the path from a thwarted individuality to a totalizing ideology. It was the individual's experience of insignificant, expendability, political isolation, and loneliness that stoked the fires of totalitarian terror. Such ideologies, Arendt observed, appear as a last support in a world where nobody is reliable and nothing can be relied upon. Years later, in his moving 1966 essay, Education After Auschwitz, social theorist Theodor Adorno attributed the success of German fascism to the ways in which the quest for effective life had become an overwhelming burden for too many people. One must accept that fascism and the terror it caused are connected with the fact that the old established authorities decayed and were toppled, while the people psychologically were not yet ready for self-determination. They proved to be unequal to the freedom that fell into their laps. Should we grow weary of our own struggle for self-determination and surrender instead of the seductions of Big Other, we will inadvertently trade a future of homecoming for an arid prospect of muted, sanitized tyranny. A third modernity that solves our problems at the price of a human future is a cruel perversion of capitalism and of the digital capabilities it commands. It is also an unacceptable affront to democracy. I repeat Thomas Piketty's warning. A market economy, if left to itself, contains powerful forces of divergence which are potentially threatening to democratic societies and to the values of social justice on which they are based. This is precisely the whirlwind that we will reap at the hands of surveillance capitalism, an unprecedented form of raw capitalism that is surely contributing to the tempering of commitment to the democratic prospect as it successfully bends populations to its soft-spoken will. It gives so much, but it takes even more. Surveillance capitalism arrived on the scene with democracy already on the ropes, its early life sheltered and nourished by neoliberalism's claims to freedom that set it at a distance from the lives of people. Surveillance capitalists quickly learned to exploit the gathering momentum aimed at hollowing out democracy's meaning and muscle. Despite the democratic promise of its rhetoric and capabilities, it contributed to a new gilded age of extreme wealth inequality, as well as to once unimaginable new forms of economic exclusivity and new sources of social inequality that separate the tuners from the tuned. Among the many insults to democracy and democratic institutions imposed by this coup de jeune, I count the unauthorized expropriation of human experience, the hijack of the division of learning in society, the structural independence from people, the stealthy imposition of the hive collective, the rise of instrumentarian power and the radical indifference that sustains its extractive logic, the construction, ownership and operation of the means of behavior modification that is Big Other, the abrogation of the elemental right to the future tense and the elemental right to sanctuary, the degradation of the self-determining individual as the fulcrum of democratic life, and the insistence on psychic numbing as the answer to its illegitimate quid pro quo. We can now see that surveillance capitalism takes an even more expansive turn toward domination than its neoliberal source code would predict, claiming its right to freedom and knowledge, while setting its sights on a collectivist vision that claims the totality of society. Though still sounding like Hayek, and even Smith, its anti-democratic collectivist ambitions reveal it as an insatiable child devouring its aging fathers. Cynicism is seductive and can blind us to the enduring fact that democracy remains our only channel for reformation. It is the one idea to have emerged from the long story of human oppression that insists upon a people's inalienable right to rule themselves. Democracy may be under siege, but we cannot allow its many injuries to deflect us from allegiance to its promise. It is precisely in recognition of this dilemma that Piketty refuses to concede defeat, arguing that even abnormal dynamics of accumulation have been, and can again be, mitigated by democratic institutions that produce durable and effective countermeasures. If we are to regain control of capital, we must bet everything on democracy. Democracy is vulnerable to the unprecedented, but the strength of democratic institutions is the clock that determines the duration and destructiveness of that vulnerability. In a democratic society, the debate and contest afforded by still healthy institutions can shift the tide of public opinion against unexpected sources of oppression and injustice, with legislation and jurisprudence eventually to follow. 6. Be the friction. This promise of democracy reflects an enduring lesson that I absorbed from Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago as a 19-year-old undergraduate wedged in the back of a seminar room and straining to hear his instruction of the Chilean doctoral candidates who would soon lead their country to cataclysm, marching under the Friedman-Hayek flag. This professor was an optimist and a tireless educator who believed that legislative and judicial action invariably reflect the public opinion of 20 to 30 years earlier. It was an insight that he and Hayek, the two have been described as soulmates and adversaries, had crafted and transformed into systematic strategies and tactics. As Hayek told Robert Bork in a 1978 interview, "I'm operating on public opinion. I don't even believe that before public opinion has changed, a change in the law will do any good. The primary thing is to change opinion." Friedman's conviction oriented him toward the long game as he threw himself into the distinctly non-academic project of neoliberal evangelism with a steady stream of popular articles, books, and